George Orwell wrote, "Every life from the inside seems like a record of failure." Today, two brilliant artists, a musician and a writer, driven by that sense that maybe life could pass them by. One is in his 70s, the other is in her 80s. Both have a creative drive unwearied by age and perhaps still fueled by that desire to be someone, to make a mark. The first is Paul McCartney, the underestimated Beatle. For many, the dominant impression of the two pillars of the Beatles was that John Lennon was the true musical genius and Paul, well, he was just the journeyman. Now, the writer Philip Norman helped create that myth with his seminal Beatles biography, Shout, in 1981, which for many really crystallised the image of John as the cool, edgy one, the poet, and Paul as the doe-eyed, cute boy. But now, Norman has focused on Paul alone in an 816-page critically acclaimed tome called Paul McCartney, The Biography, which he says is a kind of atonement for what he wrote before. Philip spoke to me earlier this morning from his home in London. You'd only met Paul, I think, twice before you embarked on this book, but you had had a long chat to him on the phone after you released that Beatles biography. What did he have to say to you?
Well, he's phoned me twice. I've only actually been face-to-face with him as a journalist those two times. When I was 22, I got into the Beatles' dressing room in Newcastle on Tyne on their last ever UK tour.
Well done, you.
And at the end of the book, 50 years later, I had come face-to-face with him again backstage in Liverpool. But after I wrote my Beatles biography, Yoko invited me to the Dakota Building, which was only 5 months after John Lennon's death. When I was talking to her, she made some comment about John saying how much Paul had hurt him. And when I wrote this in the Sunday Times in London, Paul phoned my flat in London and I wasn't in. So my girlfriend took the message, said someone called Paul has just phoned. But I never thought I'd be following up with another book, so I didn't try to find out what he meant. When I did my John Lennon book a few years ago, I got a message to him because I'd got the name of the reputation of someone who was anti-Paul. And I sent him a message saying my book on Lennon will not be anti-Paul. And he phoned me again, and this time I was in. And we had a conversation, and he agreed to help me with the Lennon book by email, answering very crucial questions of fact, which only he could answer.
Was there a sense that he was wounded by the perception some thought you left in that seminal book, Shout, that, you know, John was the true musical genius of the outfit?
Yes, that. And I was, that was unfair. And I'd realised by the time I started to write the John Lennon book that it was unfair.
You'd made a mistake.
Well, yes, I had overstated the case. I had accepted too much the general perception of Paul as someone who was very self-satisfied and didn't sort of really suffer for his art. I now discover, having written his biography, that he is, in his own way, just as insecure as John used to be. And he's never satisfied with anything he does. That's why he's still on stage at the age of 74, almost every night, doing 3 hours without an intermission.
He really does. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary.
Not even a sip of water in 3 hours.
So someone really driven for public adulation and acceptance and acknowledgement.
Yes, and always feeling, I mean, despite the enormous amount of, you know, adulation and wealth and fame, I mean, incalculable over all these years, he still feels somehow that he has to prove himself, keep proving himself.
To what extent does this John-Paul divide come down to perceptions in some way?
Well, it does, absolutely.
He's the nice one. Paul's the nice one, the doe-eyed one.
That's true, and everyone still thinks Paul was the cute Beatle, the melodious one, the tuneful one. John was the avant-garde one. John was the edgy one. John was the hard case, the rocker. Actually, Paul was the one of all the two of them who got into avant-garde art in the mid-60s, who got into avant-garde music, like using tape loops. But then John got the credit for that because they used tape loops first on Tomorrow Never Knows on the Revolver album. but they were actually Paul's tape loops. They belonged to Paul. He had made them. And that still persists, and he still kind of feels it. You know, he still does remind people that he was the one who got into John Cage music concrete, and while John was living in the stockbroker belt outside London and not doing very much at all.
And you write that in the days of the Quarrymen in Journey, in Germany, Paul was just as into the sex and drugs element of sex, drugs and rock and roll that Paul ever was, losing his virginity to a German prostitute.
Well, yes, I mean, I don't know if she was a prostitute, she might have been a stripper, I don't know, I wasn't there. But, I mean, that was very hard to resist, obviously, but Paul always knew how to control it. You know, Paul would try these things, he tried everything there was to try, but always within, you know, reason, moderation. John just went for it, you know. John took so many uppers in Hamburg, he couldn't shut his eyes, you know, at night. They were so dilated by this, you know, the amphetamines he was taking. Paul did the same, but Paul could always control it.
Mm. There's a mass of contradictions, though. I mean, to what extent was that image of being the nice one, the cute one, in some sense cultivated for his father's approval, you know, the man who said, "Now, son, it shouldn't be she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. It must be she loves you, yes, yes, yes."
Yes, how very sweet his father was. But his father was so important to Paul. Paul never had a real music teacher other than his dad, who had had a little amateur jazz band in Liverpool in the 1920s and 30s. And Jim McCartney, his dad, loved traditional brass band music, northern brass band music. He loved Hollywood show tunes. He loved the middle of the road. And that all fed into Paul's music and came out later in things like, you know, Sergeant Pepper, you know, with the feeling of the northern brass bands and the fairgrounds and all of that. His father was tremendously important creatively, but he was also a wonderful man who never earned really more than £10 a week as a cotton salesman in Liverpool, and yet made a happy home for Paul and his brother Michael, and instilled really good values, which are still there despite all the fame and the wealth. Paul is fundamentally a decent person, which is amazing in the rock business above anything else.
Did Dad, though, lead him into sentimentality? Did the influence of Dad lead him astray musically, in a sense?
Yes, but there again, you know, John and Paul were creatively sort of symbiotic. Each had an element of the other. Paul was, you know, nostalgic, sentimental, tuneful, but he also loved really hardcore rock and roll. He could do a great Little Richard impersonation in the early days of the Beatles. John, the hard case, was actually very sentimental, very romantic. And that was why if one started a song and couldn't finish it, the other one would finish the song. They could be that symbiotic together.
And also that Paul was innovative, you know, you point to it was he who demanded the string quartet in Penny Lane and pushed those sorts of boundaries.
He did, but they were not sort of, they were very tuned, they were very melodious boundaries. I mean, Eleanor Rigby is an amazing song for a young man to have written in the middle 60s, but somehow it's John's much more bleak A Day in the Life, or John's I Am the Walrus, which is so weird to this day, it sounds weird, which sort of has gone down in history as the experimental music of the Beatles.
And you're saying that that Paul was experimental as well. I mean, how do you possibly compare, you know, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields?
You can't, but again, you know, that's a song written about, a little street in Liverpool with buses and sandstone churches and fire stations. That was an amazing thing to write, you know, for the mid-60s. And everybody started copying it. Everybody started writing whimsical songs about little towns and red buses and that kind of thing.
How much damage did Wings do to his post-Beatles image?
Well, his post-Beatles image was very different from reality. Everyone thought he's so rich and he's so talented and he's so got so many gifts, you know, good looks, charm, all that. He'll just sort of glide into a solo career. But in fact, the breakup of the Beatles was traumatic for him. He virtually had a breakdown on his Scottish farm in the Highlands. He was very near alcoholism as well. He was running out of money. His only recourse, really, to save what money, you know, belonged to him out of the Beatles to sue the other three in the British High Court. And it was not easy starting Wings because everybody mocked him for putting Linda, his wife Linda, into the band because he wanted not to go away from her when he went on tour with the band. It took him about 3 years, really, for people to start taking Wings seriously. And they put out a huge commercial output because he was going for the stadium crowds, the big, you know, concert crowds. He wanted to prove they could be as big an attraction in the world as the Beatles. But among those very commercial Wings albums, there's some really still great McCartney songs. I mean, the song he wrote about John called Dear Friend, which John didn't even realize existed. If John had known it was there, John would never have written that awful thing, How Do You Sleep, you know, sniping at Paul. So he still would write, you know, a lovely McCartney song on a commercial Wings album.
Mm. My guest is Philip Norman, speaking about his latest rock star biography, Paul McCartney, the biography. Poor Linda, castigated by so many for so many different reasons. You write at one point that her charisma didn't really extend to anyone who was standing beyond about 3 feet from her.
No, she was, what she was actually was cool. You know, she had that kind of New York waspy coolness, which was not demonstrative. And people couldn't understand why this Beatle, this, you know, the most beautiful Beatle, every young woman in the world really wanted to sleep with him, why he went for someone who was not obviously, you know, so attractive and who didn't seem to brush her hair very much or care about her clothes. But what Linda realized and what, you know, she gave Paul was a home and a family, a happy home and a happy family. She had her own issues with her childhood. And it was an amazingly successful match, but it started with Linda being almost as, you know, vilified as Yoko was for going off with John. So the two of them really put up with an awful lot of horrible, you know, attacks, physical, you know, verbal abuse, all kinds of things from the fans and from the media too.
You're dismissive of the notion that, you know, the Sheilas broke up the band, whichever Sheila you want to point to, and you instead write with, you know, all the knowledge that you've gained over several of these biographies. Even the best informed commentators knew nothing about the ostracism, marginalisation, backstabbing and humiliation within the band that Paul had endured over the past months, yet still gone on trying to hold it together. Do you really see him as the victim of that piece?
Well, by that point, he had. They needed another manager after the death of Brian Epstein, and they got into a deep financial hole with their, you know, their group of companies known as Apple. And Paul had proposed that his future father-in-law, Linda's father, Lee Eastman, who was a very successful New York entertainment lawyer, should become the manager. And the others had accepted that, and then John goes off and decides to appoint Alan Klein. Paul could not stand Alan Klein. He was actually proved right in the end. He didn't trust him. And so the three of the others ganged up on Paul. And he suffered not only the awfulness of having his friends like that ganging up on him and pushing him out, but also the huge embarrassment of having to tell Linda, no, they don't want your father, you know, like it's all been arranged. So it was horrible. You know, again, you don't think of Paul McCartney having to go through extreme embarrassment and discomfort like that. But, you know, that has been a part of his life, like anybody else's life.
Mm. What did you make of his later loves, particularly that disastrous marriage to and divorce from Heather Mills? What did you conclude about his time with her?
Well, I think he went into the marriage, you know, with good intentions. Just as with Linda, he embraced all of Linda's sort of causes, like vegetarianism, animal rights. He threw himself into supporting her with those things. And with Heather as well. Heather had a terrible accident. She lost part of her leg. She was campaigning for landmine victims in the Balkan Wars and after that. And Paul really supported her and wanted to make the marriage work. But he, you know, Heather had this sort of idea that she was as big a celebrity as Paul McCartney, and you know, that was not going to make for harmony.
She comes across as a very troubled woman. Why do you think he was drawn to her?
Well, I think it was something to do with what I was saying earlier, his the sort of values that he grew up with. His mother, who died when he was 14, had been a nurse and a midwife, an amazingly caring woman. She was a kind of saintly presence in his mind. He wrote Let It Be at the very lowest point of the Beatles' sort of war, internecine war. A vision of his mother sort of came to him in a dream and said, no, don't let it go, don't be bitter, you know, let it go, let it be. And when Linda was diagnosed with breast cancer, and over a long period it became clear that, you know, the illness was terminal, he became, in a sense, her carer. And I think it was the fact that, Heather had this injury. He said to someone in Liverpool, I looked at her leg and went, ah. And that was something to do with, you know, his wanting to make a relationship with her and marry her and protect and look after her.
Mm. Some of the reviews of the book have criticised you for playing down his ruthlessness, which is, one would imagine, in ordinary life, hardly a fault in a person. he is a mass of contradictions. There, you know, you read about the underpaying of musicians, the dismissal of staff. You know, he blows up at Linda when she wants to have a biography of herself written, ghostwritten. I'm the only star in this family. And yet you point to this fundamental decency.
Well, these instances you mention, I mean, if you think, take the context of a rock superstar and you think how others behave in far lesser positions of fame, these are pretty minor. Well, certainly true that he thought, and he was right, that he could do everything in a recording studio. So he was very sort of bossy to George Harrison for years and would, you know, play George's guitar solos. He'd get on the drums instead of Ringo. That's absolutely true.
But that's appalling. You'd just leave the studio at that point, wouldn't you? And you say, here you go, here's the sticks, I'm off.
Well, that's what Ringo did in the end for a little while, you know. But they were not a group at war. When you think of, you know, Oasis and other groups who have had fistfights on the stage, it didn't happen with the Beatles. They had a lot of internal harmony. And again, in the recording studio, he was with the Apple record label. He was the main producer, the main talent scout, the main session musician. You know, that's true. That controlling this is absolutely true. But I'm saying that when you consider how other rock stars behave, this is a record of remarkably good behaviour.
So much has been written about the Beatles. When researching the book, you winkle out this lovely anecdote about Tokyo, 1980. Paul's caught with half a pound of marijuana in his luggage and he lands up in a Japanese jail. Describe his few days there.
Well, that was extraordinary because he'd been banned from Japan before, after being busted for drug possession in Scotland. And then he was allowed back into Japan in 1980. And all his band were warned, do not search through the seams of your pockets and your luggage, so there's not a grain of anything there. And they all do that. And then Paul, you know, his case is open. There's this great lump of, you know, this great lump of marijuana right on the top of all his clothes. And it's impossible to explain how he could have been so stupid. What happens then is that the legend is he was just held in a Japanese Tokyo police station for a few days. After a couple of days in police custody, he transferred to the Ministry of Justice custody and went into a really horrible old Tokyo jail called the Kasugi Prison with convicted killers and mafiosi. And he had to survive in there.
For how long?
And, for about another 4 or 5 days. And because he's so incredibly sort of upbeat about everything, he rose to the challenge. He said, I'm going to go along with the system and I'm going to be the best model prisoner there is, which he was. He almost enjoyed this horrific experience because he could stop being Paul McCartney. He was just prisoner 22 for a few days. He became anonymous again. And to him, it was almost like a sort of rather severe spa. Then, of course, it was a hugely embarrassing situation for the Japanese government, and he was released after a total of 9 days and deported.
But you write about how he sort of wooed the thugs and the murderers and the mafioso in the cell with a bit of singing.
That's right. They weren't allowed to sing, but there was this huge man with a tattoo all across his back who was a really serious Japanese mafioso who called out, "Yesterday, please." And Paul, being Paul, he sang "Yesterday" and a couple of other songs. So he couldn't just stick at one.
Well, I suppose if someone like that asks, you perform, don't you?
You do, but again, it's he could always sort of make the best of a bad situation, and that is the great example.
And what was the most surprising discovery you made about Paul?
I think it's the discovery of his true personality, really. But so different from the perception of this man who has apparently received all the gifts you can receive, huge talent, good looks, charm, and yet on the inside is so insecure and is always trying to prove himself. And that is a result, really, of great talent. Great talent is always like that. John Lennon was the same. John's insecurity came from different cause, which was his sort of dislocated childhood, but was never satisfied with anything he did, and Paul is the same.
And in some sense, is this book your atonement for your earlier, perhaps, stereotyping of him?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I absolutely admit at the beginning that, what I wrote in Shout was a misjudgment, and I withdraw it, and it was ridiculous to say that John was the superior partner. What it was this perfect match, this symbiosis of two apparently different personalities who had this amazing unity as songwriters and as vocalists too, as harmonizers, that wonderful mixture of what someone described as, the vinegar of John's voice and the virgin olive oil of Paul's harmony.
He didn't block you in the writing of it, and you spoke to all sorts of people to produce this massive tome, including half-siblings and all the rest. Have you had a reaction from him to it?
No, I think I will get one. I think I should get one because...
Bloody hell, after 810 pages, at least he could drop you a line.
I think so. He has dropped me a couple of emails, and one when I offered him the chance to read the text, a rather sort of touching email saying, I find it hard enough to decide what I think of me to read about what you think of me. And I'd sent him a letter saying what I was doing, which was to emphasize the importance of his father and also really sort of retrace the years of his marriage to Linda, which nobody's bothered to do, really. People think those are just sort of bland years of sort of worthless, commercial pop, which of course they're not. And he wrote back saying, well, your letter's reassuring, so, go ahead. But I guess I should get some sort of acknowledgement, I think.
And just finally, what's his life like now? I mean, he sort of pops up on Royal Variety performances with carefully dyed hair to much adulation, and he's got the knighthood or the whatever he's got. But what is his life like?
Well, it's the life of obviously a man who has more money than he can ever spend and is now seemingly on course with his wife Nancy. I mean, for a happy ending, one hopes that's what's ahead. He's totally made of music is what he is. He cannot stop creating music. It's as if, music is as much the fabric of his sort of physical body, as flesh and blood. And one would like to think that he's happy, but George Orwell's great line was that every life from the inside looks like a record of failure. And, with this sort of ruthless self-examination that he always has, he just clearly isn't satisfied and still wants to create and still wants to achieve new things.
Wonderful to talk to you. It's a mighty effort. Paul McCartney, the biography. Philip Norman, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Look at all the lovely people. Look at all the lovely people. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. They
lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Eleanor Rigby, one of those songs written by Paul McCartney and credited to Lennon McCartney, which sticks in Paul McCartney's craw to this day. According to his biographer, we heard from Philip Norman, the book Paul McCartney, the biography, published by Hachette in Australia. You're listening to Life Matters.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.